You are listening to the Streets MN Podcast, a place where conversations about Minnesota's transportation and land use are expanded through research and informed commentary.
Hi, this is Billy. I'm back with another Streets.MN Podcast. It's a good one. I sat down a few weeks ago, with the team from Mapping Prejudice. They are a groundbreaking historical research effort that is trying to shed light on the racist history of housing practices in Minneapolis. It's sort of an untold story, but it's a really interesting one. Joining me around the table in the basement of the Borchardt Map Library at the University of Minnesota were three people who've been in the thick of this untold story. Kirsten Delagarde, Penny Peterson, and Kevin Erman Solberg. Together, they have been researching dusty old deeds from deep in the bowels of Hennepin County history. A deed is the thing that lets you own a house. They've been taking those deeds and looking for, quote, racially restrictive covenants, which I'll tell you all about in just a second. And then they've been mapping where those restrictive covenants were located so you can see where in the city these covenants still exist, and they're not enforced anymore, but where they used to exist and where they still exist. For those who don't know, racially restrictive covenants were one of a series of historically troubling racist practices that were very widespread during the 20th century. It was one of the most obvious and oldest versions of trying to racially control where people lived. And for decades, it was written right into the mortgages of many homes in Minneapolis and in every city, basically, around the country, that you could not sell your house to a person of color. The actual language that's used is really interesting, and you're going to hear some of that in our conversation today. So that's a really interesting conversation, and we're going to get right to it. And this might seem incongruous, but I don't think it is anyway. It's actually might be sort of perfect. I have a new sponsor for the podcast, and it's a realtor, Nate Pence from Keller Williams Realty. And I'm launching a new feature. It's called Ask a Realtor. So prepare for that. In the middle of today's conversation, we'll be taking a few minutes to chat about the real estate market in the Twin Cities and what it's like to buy a home these days. So thanks to Nate Pence for sponsoring the Streets MN podcast. If you'd like to sponsor it, do reach out to me. And if you're thinking of buying or selling a home, please check out Nate Pence on Facebook at Pence Homes. That's P-E-N-T-Z, or via his page at Keller Williams Northwest at PenceHomes.com. So it's still spelled P-E-N-T-Z. So thanks to Nate Pence for sponsoring the podcast. And without further ado, check out this fascinating and important chat with the Mapping Prejudice team. Okay, welcome to the podcast. I'm here with, I'm in the basement of the Borchardt Map Library, deep below the West Bank Wilson Library at the University of Minnesota, with Kirsten Delagarde, Kevin Erman Solberg, and Penny Peterson. And you are the team behind Historiopolis.
Well, the Mapping Prejudice and, project, okay. Which is an outgrowth of Historiopolis, but it's its own thing.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to tell me what Mapping Prejudice is? What is that? Where did it come from? What are we looking at?
Sure. Okay. So Mapping Prejudice was is a project that the three of us started about 2 years ago. Well, to be accurate, Penny Peterson was the one who really got the ball rolling. She's our property research specialist. I'll back up. So about 5 or 6 years ago, I started something called the Historiopolis Project, which was an effort to shed new light on some of the darker aspects of the past in Minneapolis, specifically episodes from the past around race and racism. So Minneapolis is a city that likes to think that it doesn't have either race or racism. I was interested in using history to interrogate that assumption, and also sharing it with the broadest possible audience. So starting a website with a blog. And almost immediately when I started Historiopolis, I started focusing on racial covenants. So racial covenants are legal clauses that are inserted into property deeds that prohibit people who are not white from buying or even occupying certain pieces of land. So I started hearing a lot about racial covenants. One or two people gave me copies of racial covenants. And I was really curious to know more about where these racial covenants were, what neighborhoods they were in, how common they were. I was hearing from oral tradition. People were telling me they were everywhere in South Minneapolis, but nobody could, actually, besides these one or two examples, no one could even show me an example of a racial covenant, which is what brought me to Penny Peterson. And I said, I knew that Penny, based on her, she's written a couple books about Minneapolis history. And after I looked at her footnotes, I realized this was the woman who could teach me about property records. It was clear from her footnotes in her Minneapolis Madams book about the history of prostitution in Minneapolis that she knew her way around a property archive. And so I went to her and I asked her to teach me. And I asked her to help me find some of these racial covenants. And she tried. She did her best. She brought me down to the Hennepin County Recorder's Office. And after an afternoon, a couple hours there, I was feeling teary and in despair, even though I have a PhD in history.
What is the Recorder's Office archive like? Describe it for me a little.
Well, this is Penny speaking. It's on the fifth floor in the Government Center, and I think of it as a giant library. It has, at that point, it had cassettes, microfilm cassettes. They've gone to scanning since then. And so it's this giant library, and there was this thing called a tract index, which is the index to this multi-million page book, you might say. It's not in just one cassette, but there's literally millions of deeds and contracts and mortgages. So I was really in hog heaven. I find it delightful, but I guess not everyone shares my delight in this sort of thing. So that's what the property record office is like.
So it's all on microfilm, though.
It is on microfilm, and now it's scanned. It's actually a lot easier to use it now since it's evolving quite quickly, because later on in this process, they started scanning these things, and that's when it got interesting. I didn't realize it at the time. I hadn't met Kevin yet. But
maybe you can, I think it might be helpful to understand why I was in despair and you're in heaven in the same environment. It might be helpful to explain how property records are organized and why it's very hard to just walk in off the street. Besides the fact that you have to go through a metal detector and other things to get to the property records, they're very nice people once you get there. But why it's so hard to be like, I just want to look at my deed to my house. Or okay. I want to look at all the deeds for all the houses in Homewood, for instance.
Okay. Well, unlike many places, we just say, well, this is my address. I live at 100 Main Street or something like that. You have to know the legal address. Property goes by legal address, and that would in most cases be a lot number, a block number, and the addition name. And what is an addition? Well, it's a platted piece of land. That's the shortest explanation.
So, but, like, going back in time, you'd say this was Reed's addition, and he was a guy who owned a farm in the 1800s.
Yeah, or something like that. Sometimes we've learned that these were brought up by developers, that the racial covenants were rarely put in by individuals. They were put in by developers who were developing large-scale additions. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just individuals. And so I just thought of it, as I said, a library. But as I look at it from another point of view now, maybe that's kind of confusing. many of the deeds are handwritten, and if you can't read cursive, and some of them are pretty hard to read, you don't look in one place. It's sort of a multi-level thing, which I just find interesting because I guess I'm sort of unusual. a lot of people don't really want to know about property deeds that much, but I learned to do this many years ago. I had some corporate jobs, and what they were looking for is accuracy. So they'd have me read them, and are they accurate, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like a lot of tools, you can use them in all different kinds of ways. I can assure you my corporate masters were not teaching me to do this so I could learn about the history of the United States or learn about racial covenants, because we don't have racism in Minneapolis. The other thing is they're not organized by city. You can't just say, give me the deeds to Minneapolis or St. Louis Park or whatever. If you want, we finally this is further down the line. We made an agreement with Hennepin County, and they were, gave us many scans. Kevin will go into that. You can't just ask for a city's deeds because they're filed temporarily. It's how they come in to be recorded. So the guy ahead of you is maybe recording his deed from Minnetonka, another guy from St. Louis Park, Edina, Minneapolis, some farmland way out, you know, in the country. There's no real order. So this is how we ended up not only doing Minneapolis, but we're going to be doing Hennepin County in general.
Whoa, Hennepin County is huge.
No kidding.
So how many deeds do we think there are in Hennepin County? Just,
So there's about, for our period, and we were looking at primarily 1900 to 1960, we're looking at around probably 2 million deeds and closer to 10 million deed images. So one, you know, deed is often multiple pages, the scanned documents. In order to glean the attributal information necessary to map these restrictions, you often have to read the entirety of the record, right? Like the restriction might be on one page, but the addition name is three pages back. So the total number of images that have to be processed is closer to 10 million.
Wow, that's just one county in America. But it's a large county, but still.
And one slice of time. Yeah. For that one county in America. Yeah. So the volume of these records is pretty astounding, and this is why nobody else has ever successfully, anyway, attempted a project of this scale. There's been some work in other cities where certain areas have been sampled. Through this method, we've been able to determine that, you know, racial covenants were a very prevalent practice, but the more precise questions of extent, of, you know, when were these embedded into the urban landscape, what neighborhoods were restricted, what neighborhoods were not, how does this connect with historic demographic patterns, how does this connect with homeownership rates, we haven't really been able to get at that because the data has never been compiled in a usable format. It's just been in these millions and millions and millions of deed records.
Wow. So, let's get back to your sort of archival, panic attack or whatever you want to call it, Kirsten. And then you brought Penny on to do this, and then I want you to have me read what one of these sounds
right.
like and what
okay.
it looks like.
Yeah. So I'd gotten the idea for this. You know, just to be totally fair, I did not come up with this idea myself of mapping racial covenants. There was a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle who did this, I think, about 10 or 12 years ago. And I saw his project, Segregated Seattle. And that's what gave me the idea that it would be really cool to do this. I mean, really interesting to do this in Minneapolis. And so I called him up and I asked him how he did the project that he did, and he explained that he had recruited like 20 undergrad students who he basically chained to microfilm machines for 5 years.
So that's like Penny, you're worth about 20
at least.
Undergrads.
Oh, at least. And I was like, gosh, I don't have access to undergraduate, you know, minions, basically. So that's when I brought Penny. Well, I mean, originally I thought, oh, I'll bring Penny and a bunch of undergrads into the archives, and she'll teach them, and this, you know, the clouds will open and the sun will come out, and we'll suddenly have this map. And it was clear after an afternoon that was not going to happen. And I basically was like, I don't think this is going to happen. You know, this is not realistic with the resources that we have. And I really put it on the back burner. And in the meantime, Penny retired from her day job, and we went to lunch around right before she retired, and she said, I just want you to know, I'm really interested in doing this project, and I think I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And I scoffed. I mean, in a nice, I think in a very polite way.
I didn't think you were treating me like...
Yeah.
You weren't treating me like a crazy person, but I thought in the back of my mind, she thinks I'm a crazy person.
I was like, that's nice. I mean, I was like, oh, that's nice, you know, because I thought, you know, this is a huge task. No person in the right mind would take this on because it's just a huge task. And so I went on and I was doing other things. And then after about, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, I got a couple update emails, and then I got this spreadsheet from Penny saying, well, I've been working every day, and I kept going to the property records office, and I've compiled this spreadsheet of like 1,500 racially restrictive deeds. And I was just astounded, blown away, because this is that data set that she created is, I think, 4 times bigger than any other data set that's ever been created for an American city, I think, up until up until that moment, it's four times the number of the covenants that the undergraduates found in Seattle for the segregated Seattle.
Yeah, I remember the Seattle ones because I would teach about urban geography history here at the U for classes. And we talk about redlining, which maybe we could mention at the end of this, but the racial covenants were kind of a little earlier than that. Mm-hmm. And the examples online are in Seattle, and they're just sort of, eye opening.
Yeah.
And
that's
right. So it's cool that you're, doing that at a way bigger scale.
Yeah, well, it was all unintentional. I mean, not unintentional, but we just kind of... So then, at that point, when she sent me this spreadsheet, I had worked with Kevin on Historiopolis, and he had, when he was still an undergrad, had been teaching himself tools of mapping and had decided to pursue that for his graduate education and really had gotten all these amazing skills. And so I sent him this spreadsheet, and that's the moment I would say that this really took off. And I'll let Kevin describe his reaction.
Yeah, no, I was very pleasantly surprised when I saw that, when that spreadsheet showed up in my inbox. And, after mapping that initial batch that Penny constructed, my questions were, what's the scale here, right? Like, are we just going to map a smattering of these covenants, or are we actually going to be ambitious and try to, map the entirety of the city or, the entirety of the county? Like, what's this going to look like? And most of my work in this project has been centered around, how can we automate at least part of this process? And after working with Penny on this initial proof of concept, we learned that the county had actually digitized all of these records. It was no longer just on microfiche. And I think they finished doing that, a couple weeks or a month, maybe, before we started this project. Yeah, it was very...
Working on some of the stuff we're not, They were still working on, the mortgages and stuff like that, which we don't care about for our purposes. So they were just, they pretty much got the deeds scanned, and they were still working on others. And I had, I had taken it to the point where I said, they were very nice to me at the county. I mean, they really bent over backwards to help me when they asked me what I was doing. And then so I asked the manager, I said, are any of these deeds OCR'd, optical character recognition? He said no, and I just figured, because I have zero technical skills, okay, well, that rules that out. But I didn't realize that it didn't really rule it out, because things are either OCR'd or they're not in my little world, and so I thought...
But these are just scanned, but not in a OCR
way.
Right. So we learned that they had digitized all these deeds. And again, it was very fortuitous that they finished this right as we got started with this project. And, we met with the county registrar's office, and they facilitated a transfer. We signed an MOU where they gave us the entirety of their digitized property records, both abstract and eventually torrens for that period. And while they haven't run any of these images through optical character recognition, they're scanned images, and we can do that ourselves, which is what I did. And I pushed the entirety of these records to the Google Tesseract OCR engine.
The Tesseract.
I know, it's got a real good name, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's from A Wrinkle in Time or something. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. Google's always been good at branding, so it doesn't it doesn't surprise me they'd have a pithy title. So that process, initially, I hoped that if we could OCR all of them, that should be enough. I can figure out where in the document this language normally arises, and I should be able to write a script to extract the relevant information. But it turns out the quality of the scans is bad. I was going to say not good, but it's actively bad. And we just can't trust the entirety of the OCR-derived translation. There's too many sections of typed documents that are handwritten. There's mildew stains, there's speckle noise all over the image. The Tesseract engine just has a hard time of getting all of the relevant information accurately translated, but it was good enough where you could kind of key in on certain words. So the way I set the workflow up is, you take this batch of images, OCR it. This will spit out a host of text files that, are the textual translations of those images. Then we iterate through the text files looking for instances of language that Penny identified in that initial proof of concept. So those 1,500 or so deeds, we just took the language from those restrictions and told the computer to flag the corresponding image whenever it found one of those terms in one of those text files. And this way we're able to narrow down, millions and millions of records to the less unwieldy, although still intimidating, 10 to 20, 30,000.
What words are you looking for then?
Well, you want to read some of the covenants? That might be a good place to start.
I just happen to have some here.
Great.
Let's see. This deed is further given on the express condition, and that the party of the second part agrees that the said premises shall not at any time be sold, conveyed, leased, or sublet, or occupied by any person or persons who are not full bloods of the so-called Caucasian or white race. So-called. I like that. You can't really define it, but
yeah,
you know,
like
when
to
you
the
see
Irish
it.
Count is one of the big debates of this period, at least in the 19th century.
Yeah, probably not here. We haven't found anything that blocks Northern Europeans,
okay,
even though everyone thinks there is.
Okay, I'm again going to pause here for a moment and hear from our sponsor, Nate Pence from Keller Williams Realty. I'm really grateful to have found a sponsor for the podcast. You, if you've been listening to this, you might know that I've basically been doing this for free for many years. I think 5 years, which is a long time, on and off. I've recorded and produced over 100 episodes, and I kind of do it because I think these conversations are really interesting, and there's nowhere else you can find discussions about things like urban history and race in Minneapolis, or a host of other topics that I've been podcasting now for years. But anyway, it's a lot of work, and you can tell from the lack of new episodes, I kind of get burned out, and without any way of compensating for me for my time, making the podcast is not really a high priority in my to-do list. So, for example, I recorded this conversation that you're listening to today months ago and only now got around to editing it and putting it online. This is all to say that I'm very happy to have Nate Pence sponsoring the podcast, not only because I like Nate personally, I see him biking around town and going to soccer matches, but also it helps motivate me to get these episodes online and pays me a little bit for the work that I'm putting into this. So, yeah. Anyway, so please do support Nate and Nate Pence if you know anyone who's buying or selling a house. Also, this is letting me do something I've been wanting to do for quite a long time. It's a segment I call Ask a Realtor. I wanted to do a podcast about this before, but now I get a chance. I've always been curious about how realtors see the city in a unique way because they literally see inside homes all the time and know what they sell for. So this is sort of my chance to ask Nate some questions. I literally know nothing about owning, buying, or selling a house, so that's what I'm going to talk to him about. So here goes. I hope you enjoy this. And if you like the podcast, please support our sponsors. In this case, Nate Pence at Keller Williams Realty. You can find him on Facebook at Pence Homes. That's P-E-N-T-Z. And he's here for a short chat about the state of the Twin Cities housing market as of spring 2018. So enjoy. Well, Nate, thanks for coming back on the podcast here.
Thanks, Bill.
Or for the first time, I should say.
Yeah.
We're going to do a little series. We're kicking this off. It's called Ask a Realtor, and you're a realtor.
I am a realtor.
Did I say it wrong? Realtor?
It's realtor.
Realtor.
Realtor. R-E-A-L-T-O-R. Realtor.
I'm already learning something.
You're learning new things. Believe me, I think the first year and a half I was a realtor, I said realtor.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. But yeah, you sell and you help people sell houses.
Buy and sell homes.
Buy and sell houses.
Yep.
Well, I don't own a home, and I haven't even really considered it.
Okay.
But this is something I've been curious about for a while, and I thought it'd be cool to do this. And we're going to go through and have questions, frequently asked questions.
Yeah.
Like, for me, one of them would be what is the real estate market like in Twin Cities these days? Like, yeah. I hear things.
Yeah.
People say, oh, my God, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for only a few years, so I guess
you
don't remember the olden days. But
no.
Yeah, just tell me about what it's like out there if you are buying or selling a house.
Yeah, it's a pretty intense market right now. It's a really good market for sellers. It's a seller's market. And what's causing that is we have a very low inventory of homes for sale, and we have a lot more buyers. And so especially if you have a home doesn't have to be perfect, doesn't have to be updated even all the way, but as long as it's livable, you're going to get a pretty good return on your investment, what you paid for. Especially if your home is under $400,000. That's where there's a lot of activity right now. And a lot of that is because right now it's, 10, 12, 15 years ago during the bubble, new construction, you could get a house for $200,000, $250,000, $300,000.
The bubble right now, meaning before everything, before the real
before
estate 08, market.
Before 07, 08. Right now, you can't build a new home, single family house for under $350,000. It's nearly impossible. There's a couple out there here and there, but largely it's nearly impossible. So what that's causing is that that first-time home buyer, that price point of under $250,000 or even under $300,000 for a first-time home buyer, and that's a crazy to think about that that's a first-time home buyer price point, but it is right now in the Twin Cities, that only homes available are homes that are previously been built. So there's no new constructions that can help release that pressure, right? Because everything new is going to be over $350,000, $400,000.
Why is that?
Cost of materials have gone up steadily. I had a client who's purchasing a home down in Newport, new construction in Newport. The house that he is buying 2 years ago was $280,000. Last year, cost of materials and labor had gone up. So it was last year was $300,000. This year is $320,000.
Uh-huh.
So you've seen that go up. So cost of materials, the current political situation hasn't made things
Steel tariffs. I guess steel isn't in your
house,
but
there's
lumber.
There's lumber. Yeah. Concrete, is it really expensive? Mm-hmm. Thanks, U.S. Bank Stadium. The labor market for builders has shrunk. There's less workers. Some of them have left the country. So that's factoring into it, too. So you're seeing there's some new construction even up in North Minneapolis where we had some of the green homes north where I live in North Minneapolis, where those projects were supposed to be done far sooner, but they had a problem finding enough labor.
What's Green Homes North?
Green Homes North is a housing program that the city of Minneapolis did in North Minneapolis, that was to build homes, and I don't know how green they are, but.
Are they literally green? They painted them green?
I think some house may be painted green.
Okay.
Do you like green as a color?
You're in a green t-shirt. House, maybe not.
Yeah. And so those homes have some income like restrictions. So like I think you need to have like a combined income under $104,000. So and I think they've built 100 of those or so during this run. And those homes, there's one that's being built across the alley from me, behind me, and that was supposed to have been done about a year ago, and just finished 2 weeks ago and on the market.
Because of the lack of labor, saying, yeah.
That's what they're saying, is okay. What he says. Huh. Yeah.
So, sounds like it's a seller's market. What does that mean if you are someone shopping around? It's like, it seems like, oh, I need to put in an offer the second I hear about something or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing, though, then what that means for buyers is we're seeing multiple offer situations where you're seeing homes within 2 to 3 days of being on the market are getting eight offers.
Wow.
And they're selling above list price. I had a home in Kingfield, a 3-bedroom, 1-bath house in Kingfield, about 1,200 square feet. We went on at $249,900, had 7 offers. One was full price offer. 4 were $10,000 over. One was $22,000 over. And the winning one was $27,000 over list price. And the people who bought it had written 5 other offers and they had dealt with multiples. And there's like, in order to get the house, they had to make the decision of going that much over, 10% over list to get it. And did not expect it to go that high. And I think a lot of people are considering is, you know, if you're making this decision to buy a house, there's a lot of different things in mind. Are you looking to buy a home and living there for 5 years? Are you going to live there for 10 years? Are you going to live there for 15 years? You know, life changes, but what is your intention to live there? If you're going to live there for 10 to 15 years, right, if you pay $20,000 or $25,000 over the list price, well, that's a lot of money right now, right? But it's amortized over 30 years and, you know, what that looks like for the buyer, you know, every about $10,000 is about an increase in price is about $50 more a month in payment,
mm-hmm.
right? So
if you say so, I believe you.
Talk to a lender. I'm not a licensed loan officer. So, but every $1,000 is about. If the easy math is every $1,000 over a principal is about $4 to $5 a month in payment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to go $20,000 over the price, you're looking at about $100 more a month. So is the house, if you're going to live in the house for 10 to 15 years, is it worth $100 extra a month to get it?
Mm-hmm.
Is the kind of the look at it. And that's where some people are having to make that decision. And it's hard. And I really don't like this market for buyers. I don't like that you can't really think about putting an offer on a house. You only have a night. Maybe you can sleep on it and think about it. It's not a good position to be in. But in this market, right now we have it's pretty much about 2 months of inventory, which means if no other homes went on the market, in under 2 months, every home would be sold. And they consider it to be a balanced market if we have between 4 to 6 months of inventory.
Okay.
So we're in a seller's market.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it means for buyers is you got to get out there and be ready to dive in and get it. And for a lot of people, it's hard. If some people have time and they want to wait until the fall, it's a lot calmer. There's a lot less competition.
The fall equals autumn.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, autumn.
I was at the fall of, like, man. Or
oh,
something.
No, yes.
Well, let's not wait for that.
Well, no.
Okay.
If you wait until October,
yeah.
Right, school started, there's a lot less people out there. There's less homes on the market. That's true. But you also don't have as many people hunting. So you can kind of find some value there. Or if you wait until midsummer, there's a little bit of a lull then to ride around 4th of July if it happens. So, you know, there's some things to consider.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for talking to me about that.
Awesome.
Today.
Okay, thanks to Nate Pence for that chat. And do support him at PenceHomes.com or you can find him on Facebook at Pence Homes, that's PENTZ, at Keller Williams Realty. Thanks for the chat. And back to our discussion of the history of restrictive covenants in Minneapolis.
So what else isn't listed often in these...
Well, there's building restrictions, but we decided not to concentrate on those because it just takes too long. But sometimes there'll be things like no colored persons, nor shall the property be used for immoral purposes or for liquor business, because they're pretty much the same. They're kind of classified the same. You know, you get dark-skinned people, you get immoral behavior, you get liquor businesses.
What about religion?
Well, that's an interesting question. Many people told us when we started this that there would be many, many covenants barring Jews from living certain places. We have found, I think, about 24. I think that's largely a result of a 1919 law in Minnesota that said, barring people for racial reasons is fine. But religion, you shouldn't discriminate against that. So the Jews and Catholics had a little easier time. Now, of course, there's lots of ways of getting around this. So we find some that talk about Semitic races. Mm-hmm. You figure that out. And there's a few that are clearly could be challenged in court where they say no Jews or Negroes. Those tend to be not in Minneapolis, but further in the outer reaches of Hennepin County. But I think if you use the word Jew, you could challenge it in court because it's a violation of the 1919 law.
Okay.
So,
although, I think I've talked to a lot of people about this because this really, this finding really challenges a lot of assumptions. You know, it makes sense. Minneapolis was known as a highly anti-Semitic city. You know, it was named one of the most anti-Semitic cities in the United States in the 1940s. People, you know, it would really make sense that this would be a way that those sentiments would be conveyed, right, in racial covenants. So we were honestly pretty surprised. And of course, it made a lot of sense once we found out about 1919 law that if you wanted your covenant to stick, you didn't use religious language specifically. But there's still a lot of room for interpretation in the only Caucasians can live here.
Let's focus on what's in there then. So, which is about race and
So like the list of people. So there's the classic Seven Oaks, one of the first covenants.
Right, the first covenant that we have discovered in the city from 1910 lists. I'm probably getting them in the wrong order, but Chinese, Japanese, Mongolian, Turkish, Moorish, and those of African descent. And sometimes to that one would be added Semitic.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot like the ones that I saw in Seattle that they list on the website.
Mm-hmm. And those were the result of Edmund G. Walton. He was a real estate agent or real estate promoter. He was also English, and he was very concerned about what was going on in Europe. And that's just about the time of the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And I think he was of the opinion that all those guys from there were going to move to Minneapolis and buy houses or something, which seems a little far-fetched, but that was clearly on his mind.
There's also covenants that bar people who are living with or married to or someone of the, who's black, who's African-American, right?
Right. Those are their,
so if you're white and you are married to someone who's not white, then you are barred from living in this house. Mm-hmm. So by marriage or association.
Well, it could even be a black employee. I mean, the way that these are from the Dorman editions. And so you say you had a personal attendant who was black. You could not be, because you're living in the same house. You're in a wheelchair, I guess. You know, you'd want her there or him there most of the time. And so you'd be barred from that even. Mm-hmm.
But then some clever developer came up with a addendum that there was a exception for domestic servants.
That was fairly late, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so these got put in by the developers. And what years are we talking about here? You said you started in 1900. But then just describe like how a developer would go about building the house and putting these in and why they would do that.
Well, they wouldn't necessarily build a house. You're selling real estate that may or may not have a house on it. Basically, if say I'm Seven Oaks Corporation and you want to buy a lot in, Lenora Park or something, a lot of these are along West River Road. You'd have the warranty deed and this would be the language that was in it. And if you didn't want, I find that language offensive, I guess you won't be buying a lot there.
So do you think they sold for higher prices because they were whites only?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have an example on our website. So if you want to find out more about our project, you should go to www.mappingprejudice.org. And there's a lot of background information about the covenants. There's a map that Kevin made shows how covenants spread across Minneapolis over time. There's some other maps that he made that show demographic shifts in response to the covenants. Really, lots of great information. Where was I going with this?
I'm just curious where they originated. Were these around in the 19th century? Did they start being used in the 20th century?
Okay,
for a particular reason, or is it just real estate greed, or was like why does this start to happen?
So the earliest covenant that we found in Minneapolis is from 1910, and we have speculated a lot about why they're showing up at that time. And Minneapolis is not the first place to have covenants. Covenants started in the 1880s in California, and they were aimed at Asian immigrants, Chinese immigrants, primarily, and then they spread through the South, and then they came to the North. Like in Chicago and Minneapolis, they show up right around the same time, which is actually right around the same time that you have the establishment of the National Association of Realtors. So the two things are connected. Okay, so that's what I was going to say, that on our website, there's an example of an ad that was used that showed how racial covenants were used to market these lots and these properties. Mm-hmm. So yes, this was a selling point. This was a marketing device that realtors promoted heavily. And it enhanced the value of these lots. I think it's another important thing to realize that these covenants, in the way they're put into the property deeds here in Minneapolis, they run with the land.
Not with the house.
Not with the house.
Okay.
So you can, once they are attached to a piece of property, they never go away. They never go away. There's nothing you can do to get rid of them. So it doesn't matter how many times you resell the house, how many times you even rip down the house and build something else. If you build an apartment building on that same piece of property, all the apartments in that building will be covered by these same racial restrictions. So that's why these are incredibly pernicious and powerful instruments of racial segregation. And if it weren't for multiple, there's a Minnesota state law from 1953, there's the Fair Housing Act of 1968. If it weren't for those measures, these would still be in effect today, because it is very hard. I think Penny, as our property research specialist, can speak to this a little more, but I mean, property is king in the United States.
Property is the history of the United States, to simplify it. But basically, you lose your property if you violate it. So if Kevin put racial covenant in, sold it to Kirsten, and then she sold it to me, and then I thought, I can sell it to a black person. It's not a problem. I would lose the property, any equity I had in the property, and it would revert to Kevin or his heirs. Hmm. And it doesn't matter how long you do this. It runs with the land. So it's embedded. So that's pretty powerful. That's, you know, because people said, well, why don't they just break the covenants? What the heck, you know? You want to lose your property?
Yeah.
Most people don't.
Yeah. And so help me understand when you, the first batch of covenants or of deeds that you did, and then what are the geographic patterns in Minneapolis that you came up with? Is it mostly homes that were built after 1910?
Right. It was undeveloped areas. So as you see on the map here, as you go south, these are relatively new parts of the city. The old parts of the city, for instance, where I live in southeast Minneapolis, that was, you know, founded in 1849.
Right.
No one is worried about people of color buying property there.
In Prospect Park?
Well, actually in Marcy Homes. That's, yeah. There were black people buying property. Mm-hmm. Emily Gray and her husband came here in 1855. They owned a house in my neighborhood. It's no longer standing. But, you know, and they were free black people. We hadn't even had the Civil War. So the older parts of the city tend not to have these covenants because, you know, the developer sells to A, A sells to B, B sells to C. It's harder to get your neighbors together to say, let's put some covenants in, because why would you do that? It makes it harder to sell. And besides that, it's just harder to organize people. Have you ever gone knocking on doors to your neighbor? Let's do such and such. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas the developer, if you own the land, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. So you were pointing to areas like around Minnehaha Creek and south of there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned, Kirsten, around the Mississippi River Boulevard areas. So Longfellow. And those are areas that were developed and were growing in around 1910 and after.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, but you certainly find them in North Minneapolis. You find them, well, Kevin can speak to that.
Yeah, so what are the patterns, I guess, that you found, and why are they important, or what can we learn from them?
So before I talk too much about the location of covenants, I think it's important. I want to highlight some work that we've done with historic demographics, which I think really sort of set the stage for why we think covenants are relevant and why we think they're worth talking about today.
Yeah.
And so the Minnesota Population Center, census records prior to 1950, these are now public records, and they've compiled the raw returns in a searchable database. So well done, Minnesota Population Center. Through that data, I was able to reconstruct the demographics, the racial demographics of the city for 1910, 1920, 1930, and 1940 using something called the enumeration district. Now, this is the spatial unit the census uses to compile information. They never publish at this level. They publish at the ward or the tract or the block. You know, these units you're probably more familiar with, but they collect at the enumeration district level, which is pretty fine-grained. They would determine the location of EDs based on population, with the idea being that each enumeration district should have about 1,000 residents. So through recompiling the raw returns on the enumeration district field, I was able to map where African Americans were living in, you know, the first half of the 20th century. And in 1910, the city was not segregated at all. The ED with the highest percentage of black residents was in near North Minneapolis, and it was only 12.5% black. By 1940, there are 5 enumeration districts that are between 25 and 60% African American, even though the total population of African Americans during this period is pretty much staying constant. In 1910, 0.92% of the city was black. In 1940, 0.85% of the city was black. It actually decreased by a couple fractions of a percentage point. So this amalgamation that you're seeing, right, this concentration of black residents, this isn't a function of increased migration, for example, like the Great Migration, the influx of African Americans from the rural South into the urban North in the first half of the 20th century, which is often posited as an explanation for how urban environments in northern cities became segregated as the century progressed, didn't really happen here. The segregation that we see happened very quickly, right, between 1910 and 1940, and we believe that covenants were the driving force, that as Minneapolis expanded, the overall population expanded, and all the new developments were, you know, covered by these racial restrictions. African Americans who were living in those neighborhoods get forced out into these increasingly circumscribed sections of the interior city. So an example we usually give during our presentation, south of Lake Harriet. In 1910, there were actually 17 black families living in that in that neighborhood. And by 1940, there are zero black families in that neighborhood. And this pattern plays out throughout the city. You see a similar pattern happen in northeast Minneapolis, where by 1940, there is no census enumeration district east of the Mississippi River containing multiple black families. Well, in 1910, there was like five.
So just to question, because it seems like the map that at least the one here in front of me, it's not a – it's very patchwork or something. It's like
–
but you're saying that your guess is, your hypothesis you're working with is that there's more of these that we can't see on the map yet.
So to – and to put that in perspective, we've mapped about – in Hennepin County, we've mapped about 10,000. We've identified closer to 20,000, and we're still running OCR on an additional like 3 million deeds. So we have mapped a small fraction
it's like
of the aggregate
I'm
number.
Picturing the computer loading thing. You're at 10% or
something. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. So the patchwork dispersion that you're seeing right now, I mean, you're right. This isn't, you know, if this was the full extent of racial covenants, I think this would be a different conversation that we'd be having. But this is grossly underestimating the total number of racial restrictions in both Minneapolis and the rest of the county. But I think we do have enough data at this point where we can start to kind of sketch the contours of, like, you know, how does this look? Which neighborhoods are these showing up in? You know, how is this connecting with this, you know, really radical demographic shift? And one of the other connection points that I think is important to highlight is how, and you mentioned this at the beginning, but how do racial covenants connect with redlining? Because in a lot of ways, covenants are the inverse of what redlining is trying to do.
Yeah. Redlining is to define it. Do you want to take a stab, anybody?
Yeah. So essentially how redlining works, these were maps created by the
FHA.
Yeah, not the Fair Housing Act, the Federal Housing Administration. I get my FHA acronyms confused sometimes. And in 1934, the FHA starts insuring mortgages, which was a huge game changer for the average American. Prior to that, if you wanted to buy a home, you effectively needed cash in hand. I mean, if you knew a banker, maybe you could get a five-year mortgage. But the idea of, you know, 3.5% down, I'll repay this over 30 years, that didn't happen prior to the creation of the FHA. The FHA starts insuring mortgage. This opens up homeownership to, you know, large swaths of the American public who prior to, you know, the creation of that agency would not have been able to buy a home. But there's a catch. They won't insure all mortgages. You can't get an FHA loan for all homes. And they built redlining maps for all the major urban areas across the country that broke cities down into good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods. If you want to buy in a good neighborhood, a neighborhood defined by the FHA as a good neighborhood anyway, you're eligible for financing. If you want to buy in a bad neighborhood, you're not. You're ineligible for financing. And what that means is that areas that were redlined and on the map, they color it in red as the bad neighborhoods, hence the term.
So-called bad neighborhoods.
Yeah, so-called, yeah. Well, according to the FHA, you know, quote-unquote bad neighborhoods. Once an area is redlined, this causes property values to plummet because nobody can afford to buy a home there anymore because you can't get a loan. You need cash. You need cash in hand.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the picture in the landscape of the American cities. And it's interesting. That stuff's sort of been – you can get it online.
Yeah.
There's a lot of research about this.
Yep.
You can read the description of this neighborhood that we're in right now, the West Bank, for example.
And you're right. And there's been a lot more scholarship done on redlining. I think the – kind of public awareness of redlining is significantly higher than covenants, and in large part because redlining comes with built-in beautiful, not beautiful, but, you know, built-in maps, right? Like it's a lot, you know, aesthetically, it's easier to kind of wrap your head around redlining than it is racial covenants when they exist in millions and millions of property records. But what we're finding is that redlining was, and, you know, we already know this, right? It's explicitly racially motivated. I know one area in South Minneapolis was redlined, and according to the FHA description, I quote, due to a gradual infiltration of Negroes and Asiatics. So the quality of an area is being determined in large part by the FHA on the racial composition of that neighborhood. But you can't use redlining as a tool of divestment unless you already have heavily concentrated sections of African Americans. So in 1910, you couldn't really redline the city based on race because there was no area. You couldn't draw a contiguous polygon around the black around a black neighborhood because there weren't predominantly black neighborhoods. You know, racial covenants create that initial clustering, and once you have those clusters, this allows policies like redlining to take effect and to further you know, discriminate against and disenfranchise these communities. And then, you know, later, so, you know, covenants start in 1910, redlining starts 1930. By 1950, we're doing large-scale urban redevelopment, and they're intentionally and explicitly targeting redlined areas. In the 1960s, you start to see massive infrastructure projects, right? So the largest black community in Minneapolis at the time, near North Minneapolis, was obliterated by 394 and 94.
Mm-hmm. Where it, First Olson Memorial Highway.
Yeah, Olson Memorial yeah. First, right, right.
Plymouth Avenue.
Plymouth, yep. Yep, and the
no,
expansion
Sixth
of...
Sixth
Avenue.
North,
yeah.
Which was the...
Right, Sixth Avenue North was the first one of the first African American business districts,
right?
And it was the first large scale redevelopment project done by the city of Minneapolis in 1936. As soon as they got federal funds, they flattened Sixth Avenue North.
Yeah.
So that was before the gateway. That was before the freeways. That was the first one, and no one even talks about that. And that was the old jazz district. That's where, you know, it was a little early, but, you know, Prince's family got their start in the music biz in that area.
I've seen some pictures of the closing for the construction stuff, but I'm sort of curious. There's two more things I want to talk about before we close here. One is, what happens to those racial covenants? I guess you alluded to this earlier, but there's two legal bills that were passed, laws that were passed in Minnesota and federally, mm-hmm. so to make these sort of
null and void. Yeah, I mean, or not unenforceable, right? So there's several layers of legal complications. So there's a series of Supreme Court decisions. The most important one is Shelley versus Kramer in 1948.
Yeah, that's one
which,
I've heard of.
Yeah, so that was a major victory for the NAACP, which targeted. I mean, the NAACP had two major policy goals for the first half of the 20th century. It was school integration and racial covenants. So you hear a lot about Brown versus the Board of Education. You don't hear as much about Shelley versus Kramer, even though it's also a landmark Supreme Court decision. But that decision just made them unenforceable. So it didn't make them illegal, and developers were still putting them into property deeds after 1948, but it was just harder to enforce.
Yeah, it was more ephemeral or something. It's like, this is sort of in there, but we can't, but it's there.
It's there, and it's also, there's an inertia, yeah. And do you really want to be the person who buys a property with the possibility that you could be taken to court because you're perceived to be the wrong race? By one of your neighbors. I mean, there's a risk. It's like if you're sinking your whole life savings into a piece of property, it increases the risk, right? So in Minnesota, racial covenants were declared illegal in 1953 by a state law. And it wasn't until 1968 that the Fair Housing Act, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that the Fair Housing Act.
50 years ago.
Exactly. Yes. That, and it took the assassination of a major civil rights leader to get that legislation through Congress. That was not an easy sell, right?
And by then, all these other things were in place that had radically altered the landscape made a lot of the stuff permanent in some ways, or
that's
very
right.
difficult to change. And so I guess it sort of gets back to the other question I want to ask you about, which was where you started with this whole interrogation, Kirsten. It was about this myth of Minneapolis as a liberal, sort of tolerant city. Mm-hmm. And I think about just any friend of mine, white friends who've bought a house recently, mm-hmm. and how happy they are to find like a good deal and to go to a nice neighborhood.
Right.
And then underneath that whole like, oh, isn't that a nice house with good woodwork and whatever?
Mm-hmm.
I just always think, well, this is sort of how it all works.
Yeah.
Is that access and privilege is given to this group, and no one really talks about the fact that it's denied to others.
Yeah,
and that's
right.
why we have huge inequality today, and it's one of the big reasons, right? So. Talk a little bit about the sort of other story of Minneapolis, the stuff people don't like to think about too much, this thing that you're so focused on.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that I have focused on racial covenants, obviously, is getting at this reckoning with this myth of Minneapolis, reconciling that with the fact that we have the highest disparities in the country. Racial disparities in the country, and that our gap in homeownership rates are particularly they're the biggest in the country of any between African American homeowners, homeownership rates and white homeownership rates. So this is an acute area of inequality in Minneapolis. This is not just about African-American history. This is about white privilege, right? And I always say that that the story of racial covenants is really the story of my family. It's my personal history in a lot of ways. Well, it is. I'm a native Minneapolitan. I'm a third generation Minneapolitan, and my grandparents were Swedish immigrants who came to Minneapolis, and they both both sets of my grandparents bought houses in 1942 near Lake Nokomis, and one of those houses had a racial covenant on it, and the other one was right next to an area with racial covenants. So my point with this is just that every Minneapolitan, I think there's been a tendency to believe, first of all, that there's no race and no racism, that this is this white Scandinavian community that doesn't have any of these dynamics. And of course, I think you would have to be blind at this point to believe that. But also that we are all, this is all of our history, and you can't understand anything about the city without understanding this racial dynamic. I think there's been a tendency to say, you know, how important is it to understand African-American history? There's only, you know, only one first, so much of the city's history, only 1% of the population was African-American. Do we really, you know, is that really like the central theme of the city? And I think what this map is showing is that it is, you know, because we are all complicit in this, or, you know, those of us who have lived here for generations, whose families have benefited from this system, we're all complicit in this system of structural racism that has shaped every piece of the landscape in the city.
To this day. I mean, talk a little. How is this still alive today? How are these covenants still alive today?
Sure. One of the, and granted, it's still somewhat preliminary. We haven't mapped all the covenants yet. But the areas that are heavily covenanted are by far the whitest parts of the city today. So even though they're no longer legally enforceable, the demographic patterns that emerged from covenants, and again, in 1910, the city looked very, very differently, right? There weren't these huge pockets of whiteness and huge, or, you know, narrow pockets of, you know, predominantly African Americans. It was a much more integrated place. And through covenants, through redlining, through these policies and practices, you get this really stratified urban environment. And where the covenants were, these are still the whitest parts of the city today. They're the parts that have the most access to parks and green space. You know, they're the areas that have the city's invested more in tree boulevard. We were talking to a city council member a few weeks ago, and we found out that boulevard trees, like where the city like puts trees on like medians, happened much more frequently in the covenanted areas as opposed to the areas that were redlined. So, I mean, there's all these connections to stuff that we would take for granted. Sewer connections would be another one. Look at Minnehaha Creek versus Bassett Creek in North Minneapolis. I mean, the
point source pollution,
low birth weights. I mean, it's yeah. And, you know, as historians, geographers, like, we're not really well equipped to kind of navigate all of these different things. But, you know, covenants have had this incredibly prescriptive effect on how the built environment of the city took shape over the ensuing decades. And even though the covenants are no longer legally enforceable, the effects of the covenants, I mean, that's what we're living with, today.
And the zoning that we have today in Minneapolis was basically put into place at the moment where the covenants were at peak influence, or so in the 1950s. If I understand it correctly, and that zoning system has locked all of these inequities into place.
Yeah, I think zoning is sort of the modern version of this redlining map that we have here.
Right, it's built on the premise of the covenants and, you know, all the racial assumptions. So it almost took away that racial language, but it's enforcing the same the same inequalities. And so both city governments, both Minneapolis and St. Paul, are saying that racial equity has to be at the center of any planning or any policy work that they're doing. But they can't really understand how to do that unless they can see this landscape, this hidden historical landscape.
I think this is such important stuff. It's really helps understand where we're at politically, and I can't tell you how much I'm impressed by it. Where are we going next? Like, where are we at the project? What do I expect in the next year? Just give me 2 minutes on that, and then I can ramp it up here.
Well, build the map. So we still
that sounds
need
really like time consuming.
No. Well, it's very time consuming. We need volunteers. That's our most pressing need. Is that we need, if you find this work compelling, please go to our website, click on the Get Involved tab. and start looking at some deeds. I mean, if nothing else, do two, do five. Read this language for yourself.
Wow, what a cool opportunity, too. You just learn a lot.
Yeah, right. And that's absolutely this kind of community engagement that we cannot do this. We're a little teeny team and we have some computers. But this project would have never gotten off the ground if it hadn't been for the hundreds and hundreds of volunteers who are giving their time to annotate these deeds.
And for Penny just doing it on her own, too, it sounds like.
Penny is our secret weapon. It's true. But she, you know, it wouldn't be a project. Yeah, we couldn't have done it without. And we are totally humbled by the generosity of and the enthusiasm of our volunteers. But we also feel like that's central to what we're trying to accomplish. Getting, you know, don't take our word for this. On this work, on this history, go read those deeds for yourself and see how that, you know, grapple with that, confront that history. So that's like front and center for the next year for sure. And we hope out of that experience, we can continue to have community conversations about what needs to be done, you know, because the map is a prompt. The map is just the beginning. We're not doing this just as an academic exercise to say, hey, isn't this interesting? We're doing it because we want to change, we want to change things going forward. Mm-hmm. But we're not in any position. The three of us have varied skills, but we're not policymakers and we're not organizers and we're not community activists. But we are just so thrilled to be in conversation and be in collaboration with people who have those kinds of skills.
Great.
So starting conversations, and we hope that people will take the data that we are creating and do all kinds of things with it.
I hope so too. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today. And this has been just a really amazing conversation for me and hopefully for the listeners.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Streets MN podcast. If you are interested in joining a conversation about Minnesota's transportation and land use, direct your browser to streets.mn. Content for Streets MN is volunteer-driven.